Okay, well, good morning. I'm Michelle Davis. I'm Executive Director of Nonprofit Connect, and welcome this morning to our religion and faith-based sector session. Part of the result of the incredible Giving USA and Giving in Kansas City reports that were published this summer. Want to just share with you for just a second about the materials that are on the table in front of you. You have some great materials from Jeffrey Byrne and Associates, and also about the Giving in Kansas City and Giving in USA, Giving USA reports that they're going to go over with you. You'll also see a yellow sheet that identifies some of the other upcoming training programs that Nonprofit Connect is offering through the end of the year. One of the things you'll see mentioned there is the Philanthropy Midwest Conference. If you haven't already received one of these in the mail, we have these out at the table. The conference is November 18th and 19th. You can choose to come one day or you can choose to come both days. It's a the largest nonprofit industry conference that's offered in the region. So it's a great opportunity to get national and regional experts here providing training without having to travel, you know, to a coast to get this same kind of training. The other thing I would make note of is that we do have some scholarships available. And if you have any questions about that, just see me. The scholarship deadline to apply is this Friday. So if you have questions, just let me know. Okay, so today we're here to talk about the Giving USA and Giving in Kansas City reports, but then also some information that you all helped us learn about what's happened with giving at your organizations in the last 9 months. And I want to first start by thanking Jeffrey Byrne and Associates and the Greater Kansas City Community Foundation. For years, they've been very dedicated to Kansas City, especially through the ongoing production and bringing the Giving USA reports to Kansas City each year. But their dedication to really helping us take that information to the next level has really been incredible this year by the development of these sector sessions. So I want to say, first of all, a big thank you to both of them for helping us through this process. We have been operating what are called learning circles. Nonprofit Connect has been operating learning circles for the past several years, and we have them in a variety of topic areas, one for funders, one for executive directors, and then we also have one for faith-based and religious organizations that's been operating the last year. We are going to continue those, of course, in 2010, so that we're hoping that the session today brings new awareness to people that maybe haven't been involved in that before about the opportunity to get together with people who are doing work similar to yours several times a year. We do it quarterly so that you continue to network with one another and serve as a resource to one another. So those will continue in 2010. Our newsletter will be out later this week, and that will also provide you the calendar for 2010. The other hope is that by coming together today that you are able to identify through the discussion that you'll have a few other people that you're going to want to network with over the coming year that you'll continue to use as a resource or can share with. And that also if you are here today and there's someone that you often work with that's not able to be here, that you invite them to be a part of the faith-based learning circle in 2010 as well. The last thing I wanted to let you know is two ways we're going to continue the learning outside of those faith-based learning circles in 2010. One is that we are podcasting today's session, which means we are auto-recording it. So as you ask questions today, we're going to make sure that we get you on the mic so that you are recorded. But that way, if there's something you want to go back and listen to that you from today's session, you can go online. Listen to the download the audio portion of today's seminar. Also, you'll have access to the handouts there as well. And then in January, Nonprofit Connect is going to be publishing notes from today's session as well in a special supplement of our eLink magazine. So there are several ways to really continue the learning that's going to start today. So we're excited that you're with us. And with that, I am going to turn it over to Barbara O'Hearn with Jeffrey Byrne & Associates.
Good morning, everyone. How are you? You're really thrilled to be here at 8 o'clock in the morning, right? I know. It's not my finest hour, but I'm here and I'm happy to be here. I'm going to begin by, if you haven't already, put your name on a table tent with big letters like this. Some of you follow directions very well. Thank you. There are markers floating around the tables. It's going to be helpful for us to see you, and if you don't participate, we will call on you and get you engaged in this session. You can see who is going to be speaking with you today and presenting, but I want to start this morning by asking everybody in the room to introduce themselves and the organization they represent. So who wants to be? No commercials, please, just what organization you represent. Why don't we start? Gary, we'll start with you.
I'm Gary Hicks, and I'm representing Grace Building Trinity Cathedral.
I'm Harold Johnson. I'm a recovering banker. I'm representing Faith and Living Standard and Worship Center.
Okay.
I'm Trudy Gavin with the Nonprofit Connect.
Okay. All right. So what brought you here this morning besides your car? I mean, why did you get up and decide, okay, I'm really going to go to this meeting because I want to get something out of it? What is that something that you would like to take away at the end of the day? Oh, the morning, sorry.
A local demographic on giving.
Okay, the local. Okay, Clayton.
We're involved in a strategic plan at the cathedral, and just as Clayton said, just to get more information about giving locally, but especially related to faith-based.
Okay. Yes, Mark.
We're involved in a capital campaign currently to raise money for a shelter, a new lodge in Johnson County, and how we can do that better.
All right. Anybody else want to share? All right. So I want to ask everybody to turn off their cell phone, or I have a great fundraising strategy that you might want to employ. It's called the trap method. And what you do is if your cell phone goes off during the session, you are invited to write a $100 check to your charity or your organization. And believe me, one meeting I collected $600 checks, six $100 checks. Another one I collected four $100 checks. Then the word got out, she's serious. Now, this started out as a joke, but people stepped up with the checks. So if you'll kindly turn them off, or as one of the rectors in the church I attend said, let's turn off everything electronic and turn on everything spiritual for the rest of the session. And we will accept $100 checks, of course. So first of all, I want to share a little bit. When I do workshops, one of the intentions I want to come out with is to be really inspired, to have a good time, and to have a lot of interaction with the people participating. I feel that if we're really going to have a meaningful workshop and exchange, then it's everybody's responsibility to partner with one another and with the presenters in sharing information, ideas, and suggestions. So I'm really going to ask you to do that. One thing I want to start out sharing with you, and then I'm going to ask my colleague, Jennifer Burlow, to come up. So I want to share a story. And can you hear me if I move out here?
Barbara, I think you can, but the podcast can't. Sorry.
Okay. I'm a recovering college professor and behind a lectern makes me very nervous these days. So anyway. Last summer, I attended an event called Empty Soup Bowl, and it was in the Vail Valley where I have a great fondness for the beauty that is there and the wonderful people I've met. And this started out to be a $20 event. You got a bowl of soup from the finest restaurants in the valley, one bowl, and then artists in the community had created these bowls, and you took it home, the empty bowl, to remind you, and you know, I have it on my desk, that reminds me every day that there's people who do not have, one, a beautiful bowl, or two, any food to eat. So this started out, and they said, well, if we have 200 people, we'll be ecstatic. They had over 300. It was driven by volunteers. It was benefiting the Salvation Army, so it had very little staff time, very little upfront money. Over 300 people showed up, and $9,000 was raised in 2 hours. And so I was very inspired by this event, and I've told everybody I can find who will listen to me about it because it was so personally meaningful to me. But it showed the power of volunteers when they get a good idea. And then the publicity was astounding. As a result, the Salvation Army is going to keep their food, their pantry operating because there's been a 200% increase in need in that valley, and that will keep them operating probably for 5 or 6 months because they're not getting the donations. So let's begin with Jennifer, and thanks for being here.
Thanks, Barbara, and thank you for being here this morning. A little perspective of where I'm coming from. I'm a board member of the Giving USA Foundation, and so I've had the pleasure of working with Patrick Rooney, who I hope some of you at least got to hear give the larger overview on Giving USA and giving in Kansas City. I'm seeing some heads nod. So actually, if you'd give me a show of hands, how many of you were here with us in July? That will help me. Okay. We're not going to retread that information, but I'm going to give you a quick snapshot on bringing us back to Giving USA. But more importantly, when my husband and I moved back here to Kansas City in the early 90s, we found a home about three doors down from what would be our church home at St. Andrew's Episcopal Church. And I have been involved with the church over the years on their altar guild, their women's service ministry, and serving on their vestry, their board of directors, and most recently serving as a Cub Master for a very large pack of Cub Scouts there. And so that's how I'm serving St. Andrews. But about 4.5 plus years ago, Dennis Chapman, who's sitting here in the audience, approached Jeffrey and I and said, may I come to one of your workshops and I will take pictures for you, because Dennis is a great photographer, if you'll comp my registration. And that started a wonderful, rich relationship that ultimately, Dennis, I'm going to advertise for you, has helped us raise almost $14 million for the city's largest homeless shelter and, more importantly, one of the strongest gospel rescue missions in the country. And through that, I have had been blessed by lots of learning about the evangelical movement and getting to know pastors at the big six churches. And so, Clayton, I had already visited with you about Adam and the work that you all do. And we're just very excited about this opportunity. And I particularly am excited about this sector session because, frankly, just like the word, it's good news. So let's move on, and we'll start to talk through. Oops, okay, what am I doing wrong, folks? There we go. Okay, so let's talk about the big picture, starting with Giving USA. Here's the big numbers, $307 billion. Now, if you were really sharp and followed last year's report, you would know that the 2008 Giving USA for 2007 numbers also said $307 billion, no change. However, when we do these reports each July, they are giving you an estimate. By the end of last year, December of 2008, we learned that giving in 2007, the previous year, was actually $314 billion. So it was the highest amount ever recorded in American history. So from that high in 07 to a dip in December of 08, there was about a 5.7% decrease adjusted for inflation. Maybe not as bad as some would expect given the events of a year ago. What you see here is how those dollars are divided up by sources, and we're going to focus today, particularly my colleague John Marshall, quite a bit
on giving from individuals, because that's where it's at, for giving to religion and faith-based organizations. But let's just put a couple of these numbers together. You can see that corporations and foundations combined represent about 18% of total giving. So the message that we give to nonprofits and to their boards is that when you talk about charitable giving, 82%+ comes from individuals. When you consider the number of foundations that are controlled by individuals, which is about another 5% of that total pie, we are talking about 87% to 88% of total giving in the United States controlled by individuals. So that's a little takeaway for you. Now, what does that look like when it flows into nonprofits? Again, these are GivingUSA numbers. We'll look at what it looks like in Kansas City in a moment. The good news for you is that religion is the largest share of the pie. This is contributions from all sources. A little historical footnote here. When Jeffrey and I started fundraising some years ago, religion traditionally made up about what? Anybody want to guess what percentage of the pie? Oh, not to put too fine a point on it, but yeah, around 50% of the pie. And this does not, now that it's at 35%, does not mean that giving to religion has decreased. Giving to religion, in fact, continues to be the steady eddy that increases by a few percent each year, and because it's such a large percentage of the pie, it represents a lot of the charitable giving. It's that the pie has increased. So what you see here is new sectors that have come up that have become statistically significant. I don't have a little marker here, but gifts to foundations would be one example. That's a relatively new phenomena over the last 20 years. Certainly international affairs and environment and animals. And look at the purple slice of the pie, that little teeny 1% grants to individuals. That is brand new and was the first time that that level of giving has been statistically significant. The other thing that you should know about this pie chart is that this year giving to religion went up for the first time in terms of a percentage of the overall pie. It was 33% for quite a while. So it went from 50 down to 33. It means that what we are doing, and it may be just a general change in the sea tide, in the sea, in terms of affinity with religious and faith-based organizations. But when you're talking hundreds of billions of dollars, a 2% change is pretty significant. So, reason for optimism, good news. And when we're talking about looking at all the slices of the pie, this pretty well tracks people's preferences in terms of giving for household giving as well. So let's look at what it looks like compared to these numbers compared to Kansas City. You can see here with the light blue bars and the dark blue bars that Kansas City's sources of giving are slightly different. The foundation and corporate community here gives a little bit larger share of the pie. Bequests down at the, I guess it would be the far right as you're facing it, trail behind Bequest nationally, but that is only a snapshot for the point in time that the study was taken. So you can't really glean a whole lot from that. It sort of depends on who died with large estates with a charitable intent during that year. And the 8% for the United States may have included some of the trust activity from the Joan Crock estates and may have also included some activity from the Walter Annenberg estates. So, again, the GivingUSA people will say it's good to measure that and to try to increase bequest giving, but the fact that it was lower in Kansas City is not necessarily a telling trend. What was interesting to me, though, is when you tie bequests and household giving together, you've got about 75% coming from individuals. That is an opportunity for you, because what are we driven by? Individual giving.
Is there any trend that is evident there? That's just a point in time in 2000.
We have benchmarking in the report, the Giving in Kansas City report, which is available on all three of our websites, Nonprofit Connect, Community Foundation, and JB&A. And it actually tracked the giving from 08, 07, 08, going back 10 years and then 10 years prior, or maybe it was 01 and then 98. And Dennis, I don't know the answer to that, but that data is in there. What Melissa Brown, who's the chief researcher for the Center on Philanthropy, and what Patrick Rooney, who is the director of the Center on Philanthropy, would say is you can extrapolate out that on the sources side, it doesn't usually move very much from year to year. So, except for the bequest giving, and then it kind of goes like that. Okay? So let's look at what the differences are in terms of giving to the sectors, Kansas City versus the United States. Wow, this is where we start to see a difference. We've got Kansas Cityans giving 42% of the pie. Remember the 35% before? 42% to religion. That's great news. Now, we asked about that, and I wondered, and Lori Larson will probably allude to this at least. I wonder if it's a function of the fact that we have a number of headquarters of world churches here. In Memphis, one of the other regional reports, they used to say that they weren't only the Bible Belt, they were the buckle of the Bible Belt. Their giving to religion and faith-based organizations is pretty high. Well, I think that we can also claim that here in Kansas City. Certainly, a lot of it is driven by evangelical members, and in, John will talk a little bit about that, about how that impacts household giving, and so we would expect that that's some of the conclusions that we can draw. Now, the other two pieces to point out here that I think tie to that is that you'll see that Kansas City giving outpaces the nation when you're looking at human services and public society benefit. Public society benefit being Catholic Charities, Jewish Federation, United Way, causes that take care of human need. And that's where a lot of our ministry dollars go, right? So when all those are combined, certainly that by and large, and that was our headline in the Kansas City Star when this report came out, that Kansas Cityans care about human needs and about their fellow human beings. Yep. Giving to foundations. Giving to foundations. And you know, I apologize for that. We had a sector session with the Funders Forum about a week ago, and Melissa Brown actually addressed that. And I think it was a function of them not measuring that during the year. Giving to foundations would be individuals setting up private foundations and funding those. And for a variety of reasons, dealing with the methodology and the cost of the study, I think that that was not tracked as a benchmark. However, there is some data with respect to that in the foundation section of the Giving in Kansas City report. Okay. Now, you know, and to that point, Harold, when you look at if you envision this as a pie and you looked at the national pie, there's always a percentage that's unallocated that they just can't quite track. And so I would probably chalk that up to that. Okay? All right. This slide is what's called a histogram, and it shows the sources of giving to each sector. And so, for instance, taking the top bar, environment and animals, you've got a fairly evenly spread grouping of giving about, well, roughly 25%, 25, 25, 25, 25, only it's 21, 30, 18, 31, from the different sources. 21% from individuals, meaning household giving, 30% from foundations, 18% from corporations, and 31%, I believe, from bequest giving. I guess it's the other way around, 18% from bequest giving. The slide didn't – we will have a corrected slide up on the website. It's not showing the bequest and corporate giving on that. But the point is, down below, look at religion. You know, if you didn't know it before, it's individuals that you need to be focusing on for acquisition, for telling the message. And as John will say, it's all a function, as what Patrick Rooney says, of how many butts are in the seats. So engagement is the key for individuals. Now, we know that some foundations can't, by the way they're set up, give to religion and faith-based causes. It was interesting to note when we did the funders forum that corporations, by and large, don't shy away from giving to religious and faith-based causes in Kansas City. So let's look at that. Actually, I'm going to skip over that. Here we go. This is something that I don't want you to get hyper-focused on, but it is probably something that you should be thinking about with your organization, particularly the faith-based organizations in the room, as opposed to just the standalone churches. Corporate giving in Kansas City represented $150 million. That's a lot of money. And Melissa Brown, in reviewing this for the Funders Forum, pointed out that it's not so much that top line that's interesting, the fact that large organizations got a mean or average gift of almost $1 million, and small organizations got $1,300 as an average gift. I have a reflection on that. But she thought it was quite interesting that it was fairly evenly spread. The willingness of corporations to give to small, medium, and large organizations was not skewed toward the large organizations. Although, as we know, as we're looking at special events, and whether it's you're talking about empty bowls, Barbara, or we're talking about City Union Mission Stuff the Truck, or in the secular world we're talking about Juvenile Diabetes Walk for Diabetes or something else, Komen, corporations that are looking to give and tying to organizations are looking for what? What, Kate?
Recognition
translated in terms of what, return on investment? The more sizzle and the more exposure and the more reach you can give them, the more attractive you're going to be from a cause marketing standpoint. Now, many of you are working in critical human needs, and clearly from that September 22nd session, corporate funders and foundation funders are saying that's where we feel obligated to put our investment. So let's go back for a second and look at foundation funding. Now, what does this slide tell us? The average gift, if you looked at all foundation funding nationally from the Center on Foundations, you would learn that the average foundation gift, taking into account thousands of foundations and millions of nonprofits, is about $30,000. So what this slide shows us, that in the areas of international, arts, culture, and humanities, education, public society benefit, those sectors are doing a little bit better than the national norm in terms of the average gift. Where's religion? Way down at the bottom, half the gift. Not surprising. Remember, 96% of what you get comes from individuals. The thing that was telling to us, and if you remember Patrick being here in July, he pointed this out, look at the median gift. Median, in this case, meaning half the organizations received gifts above that level, and half the organizations received gifts below that level. Where is foundation funding for religious and faith-based organizations? The midpoint foundation gift is $1,600. So what does that tell you in terms of where you should be focusing your efforts? Okay, it's all back to households and to individuals. That is, I'm sharing that with the footnote of this very fresh and contemporary information that you probably already know. If you are serving critical human needs, you need to be cultivating our foundation and corporate community in Kansas City just as you would an individual major donor. So if household giving is where it's at, John Marshall, who is our colleague and former Salvation Army associate, has done quite a bit of research on what household giving looks like and what that means to you. So I'm going to invite John up. Thanks. This moves it forward and that moves it back.
Well, that's simple. Good morning.
Good morning.
I moved to New York City in 2004, and I was invited by the Salvation Army to be their director of development. The Army in New York City is pretty big, and it was a great opportunity for me to serve the Salvation Army, where my roots are, and also to play in quite a candy store. There's more fundraising going on in New York City, as you can imagine. My right, Clayton, you've probably been there raising it. When I moved there from Oklahoma City. Now, a cultural difference, you can imagine, between the two is enormous. And I was told by some that, you know, it's going to be different for you. The pace is much faster. People are a little bit more direct, not necessarily willing to get out of your way as you're walking down the street. What I wasn't quite prepared for was every morning when I walked out of the subway station two blocks from my office and made my way to the office, how many people approached me on the street asking for money. Now, I understand even in the best of times, people are going to have difficulties and you're going to find people asking for help on the street. And at first, I was just, you know, handing out money and not knowing what to do. And then I kind of got callous towards it and just kind of brushed by these people after a few months. Until one day, although disheveled looking, but a young fella came up to me. And he was very articulate and made his pitch to me and asked me for money. And this time, rather than just brushing him off, I engaged him in conversation, and I said to him, well, young fellow, you must know that particularly here in New York City, of the tremendous benefits there are for someone in your situation. The city offers support, the state offers support, and even the federal government. There are all offices here in this city that can help you out. And he looked me right in the eye and he said, well, sir, obviously you are not aware of the latest requirements to receive support from those agencies. I said, no, enlighten me. He said, well, in order to receive support for now from the city of New York, the state of New York, and the federal government, I have to go out and raise matching gifts from the private sector. I thought that was a rather unique response to my question. So I said, well, how much do you need? And he said, well, for $50, you can be a sponsor. For $25, a patron, and $10, you can be a friend. So I gave him $10 and became his friend. I tell you that story because as fundraisers, we all have to be creative, and we have to be unique in our approaches. This young fellow obviously had thought it through and had prepared his elevator speech, so to speak, that we're all aware of, and had presented me with some good choices. And so he got my gift. We all need to be creative. Now, we're going to talk a lot about today about numbers and statistics. I have done a lot of research. It's all out of the Giving Kansas City report. But if you, like Jennifer said, don't leave here understanding that the money that you probably ought to be focusing on is being held by households, then I think you didn't really grasp what we were having to say today. When you consider 42% coming from the Kansas City giving pie, from households, from individuals, and of that 42%, 96% of it going to the sector that you are representing here today. I wanted you to look at this slide because it is one of the first of my highlights. It talks about the fact that the average household gift here in Kansas City is $3,375. Now, if you look at the national average, you can see that it's well above that. The percentage of that is about 50% higher than what you will find being given on the national average. Another good thing is that 69% of all that is given by households, 69%, almost 70%, remains right in the greater Kansas City area. Kansas Cityans want their money to have a local impact. So you can count on almost 7 out of 10 gifts coming from individuals and wanting to stay here in the area. I'm always interested in what causes people to give. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about causes for household giving. Here in Kansas City, households with incomes of $100,000 to $200,000 are more prevalent than what we find on the national average. There are more people in that income range. There are more Kansas City residents with college degrees than you find nationally. We have a more educated populace here in which to approach. And third, more Kansas City residents are working in the traditionally high-end professions here than the national average. Let's take a look for a moment at... I want to go the other way. Okay. All right. Now, where are households giving their funds? Let's take a look at this slide. Again, you can see that the preponderance of giving is going to religion, 58%. The next figure, the next highest figure, is all the way down at 12% with basic needs, and 11% going to public sector benefits. That's, again, the United Way's Jewish Federation and other like organizations. So you can see that well more than half of the pie is going to religion. And that, I think, is significant as you continue to think about how you're going to raise funds. I'm also interested in factors that influence individual giving. I think there's three things that I'd like you to look at this morning. One is income, one is education, and one is age. Here are three levels of income. We have individuals who are giving less than $50,000. Individuals who are making less than $50,000, individuals who are earning between $50,000 and $100,000, and then the $100,000 and above individuals. Now, in each case, Kansas Cityans, with the exception of the lower level, are giving more than the national average. Take a look at the $100,000. What a difference in average gift. You see that folks who are really making decent salaries are giving substantially more. That's about 78% more than what we see folks in the same salary range giving around the country. Those in the $50,000 to $100,000 range are still giving more than the national average. The only area that is a little lower here in Kansas City, and it's very marginal, you can see it's only less than $100 average, are those who are earning $50,000 or less. In terms of education, I talked earlier about the fact that Kansas Cityans overall are more educated than we find nationally. Take again a look at the average giving by degree of education. Those with a college degree, nearly, not quite, but nearly twice as much as what we find on the national average. So we have more people with college degrees in Kansas City, and those individuals are giving more than you see on the national average. The other two are somewhat equal. You see that people with some college, could be 2 years junior college, maybe a year, what have you, are about the same as the national average. So I guess it's no secret that when you're looking for gifts and education may be a criteria, you're going to want to look at those folks who have completed their college education. Here in Kansas City, our giving for folks who do not have a college education, high school, or some high school, perhaps just more than a high school education, but not a college degree, are giving a little bit more than what you see in the national average. In terms of age range, this is interesting to me. Look what Kansas Cityans are doing compared to the country. In all three age groups, individuals below 40, 40 to 64, and 65 and above, there is a pronounced difference between Kansas Cityans' giving and the lower two age groups as compared to the national average. We think that's significant. What it says to us is that younger people and middle-aged people are really informed and tuned into the need for solid philanthropy in this country. Now, the older category, the average gift is just slightly more, about $240 more average than the national average, but it may say something about how seniors in this community look at philanthropy and where they need their philanthropic dollars to go. I was at a Royals game the other night. Did anybody watch the Royals against the Yankees last night? Show of hands, Clayton. I wept with joy because I'm a Yankees fan. Sorry. No, I lived 3 years in New York. What are you going to do? And I went to one of the games where they were quickly losing. I mean, it was really not very good. They were playing the Twins. It was the middle of the season. And there was a very large crowd because, you know, the Twins attract a lot of people, but the Royals like to see the fans like to see the Royals play the Twins. There's some really good rivalry there. So the stadium was full at the end of the game. By about the fifth inning, we were about 8 runs behind. So I expected the stadium to kind of thin out. Got to the ninth inning. It's the bottom of the ninth inning. I'm telling you, just about everybody in my section was still there, and I looked around the stadium. The place was still packed. Folks were enthusiastic. Let's go. Royals, oh, whatever they do, organists playing, everybody cheering. And they were by like 8 or 9 runs behind by this time. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, these people really care about this baseball team. And after the last out was made, everybody stood up and applauded and thanked the Royals for their effort, even though it wasn't enough to have won the game. And I thought to myself, Kansas Cityans really do care. They really are a compassionate people, even with a team like that. That's not doing well, and it's so far behind. They stayed. They supported. They want to see their community, even their sport team, do well. Having said that, I'm not going to see the Chiefs play this year. Not good. Maybe a different crowd out there. I don't know. What do you think, Gary? But anyway. So let me go to the next slide, a little bit of diversion there. Here's another thing that I think is interesting, particularly for you folks who are pastors or working very closely with churches. Take a look at what frequency of attendance has to do with giving. I found this very fascinating. You take a look all the way to the far left. For those folks who are attending church more than once a week, look at the giving. For total, that's total giving, but look for it for religious organizations and look for it for secular. People who are going to church regularly twice a week are very, very generous. And it's not that far of a fall off from even those who are attending once a week. But you can see it slides down so that by the time you get over to those who never attend church, they're not giving nearly as much. As a matter of fact, those who gave, who never go to church, give about 10% or 11% of those who are going twice a week. So those in your church who are there frequently are probably those that you ought to be getting even better acquainted with. It's pretty important stuff. All right. Now, why do people give? Why do households give here in Kansas City in particular? I was curious to know, and the report answered this quite nicely. What is it that causes households to want to give? What were the major reasons? Number one, in the report it talks about those with more. The number one factor, those with more should help those with less. Number one reason, I want to look out for my brother, my sister. The donor is identifying with a certain cause. That seems to be a strong motivational factor for individuals to give. They really identify and have a very strong tie to your particular cause. People want to achieve change. I don't like the way things are going, and that to me is very important that we bring about change, and I'm going to give my money to bring that about. Interestingly, the lowest factor for giving that came out of at least the report from households was that their employer asked. Does that surprise you at all? Did me a little bit. But maybe they, you know, I don't like to give because my employer put the arm on me. But I'm more interested in making change. I'm more interested because I love that organization and I really relate to it. And what do I really want to do? I want to help those who don't have. That's so typical Kansas City. I'm so impressed with that.
Reciprocity means,
Gary. Feel tethered to this. Gary, what that means is that, you came to me and asked me for a gift for a campaign that you're working with, and now it's my turn to come back to you. Does that happen to anyone here at all? Over the happens to me all the time, and I'm the guy out asking for money. So that's what reciprocity is. Thanks for asking.
Conversely, is there any data about why people do not give?
Going right there, right now. Thank you very much. He's a shill, by the way, and he's planted. Thank you for asking that question. Well, it's not on this slide, but let me respond to that because I was intrigued by that as well. Let me ask you, what do you think the number one reason people stopped giving? Anyone want to venture a guess?
It was not being asked.
Okay. Good answer. Anyone else?
Not connected.
That's one of the answers. Thank you, Jan. That's one of the answers. Number one reason, too many appeals. Too many appeals. Now, some not-for-profits think if we just send out one a month, you know, eventually we're going to wear them down and they're going to give. But the statistics tell us that because there are too many appeals, almost 70% of households name that as the number one reason that they stopped giving. Almost 70%. Scott, you in the Army. Scott Jusvig is here. He's the director of develop of the Salvation Army here in Kansas City. I know direct mail is a big piece, and I'm assuming that you guys need to look at frequency of mailings as well, and do you?
Well, about 3 years ago, we looked real hard at frequency of mailings and saturation within what was our donor fatigue level, and we switched our vendors first and foremost. And second off, we started a campaign where, heaven forbid, we asked our donors how often they wanted to give. Who would have thought? And then we were good stewards, and that's all we asked them for. And we found that giving actually increased. In fact, most of the donors fulfilled at a higher rate than what they told us. They would tell us they would contribute $80, and they were contributing at $120 level. So we actually got fulfillment at a higher rate than we anticipated. Our costs went down because we stopped mailing to a significant percentage. This program that we do is now our third largest gross revenue and our second largest net revenue program in all of the direct mail that we do in Kansas and Western Missouri. It is second only to thank you notes. So
it may be fair to say that your average gift went up for those that you had said, how frequently do you want us, because you paid attention to them and you asked them the question and they appreciated it.
Funny how that works.
Yeah, it really is. So, you know, we like to say that the three ways to communicate with people in raising money is through the mail, over the phone, and in person. And I think we all know that the personal touch is going to be the most effective. But even in arranging to be less frequent in the least attractive way to raise money, there can be potential positive outcome, as illustrated by Scott. Yes, Dennis?
We tried that same strategy 3 years ago and asked our major donors how frequently they can make offers when they did it, and that sector was off by $350,000. So it just
can go either way.
It's not always a formula, is my point.
Yeah.
There's still a sentiment out there because they were out of sight, out of mind, and they didn't send to us.
Yeah. How'd you overcome that? Again.
And said, okay, we did what you asked, but remember us?
Yeah. And did you make it up? Okay. Very good. The last slide I'd like to show you has to do with bequest giving. You heard Jennifer talk earlier the fact that you really, it's kind of hard to figure out exactly what kind of trends you have from year to year because bequest giving is, again, dictated by who passes away. But here is some interesting information. It shows you that the number one recipient of bequests is higher education. Not surprising. Higher education does a terrific job in inviting people to leave a legacy with them. You see names on college buildings. You see scholarship funds with names on them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not sure our sector here does as good a job with that as they could. It may be something for you to think about. But here's some things we do know about bequest giving. One, the average bequest received by Kansas City charities was $25,000. Two, 10% of Kansas City households reported having a charitable provision in their wills. Now, here is this wonderful sector here in Kansas City that is going way beyond the national average in its giving, and yet only 10% of those households have made provision in their will for charity. Says to me that there's a tremendous opportunity for us to be out there practicing planned giving and to be talking to people about the easiest way to make a planned gift, and that is to put the provision in your will. Thirdly, groups most likely to provide a charitable bequest, and this is important for you. The group that is more likely to make a charitable bequest, the top group, is people who attend worship, 18%. People who attend worship. And evangelical Christian groups give 16% of that is from evangelical Christians. And conversely, groups least likely to provide a charitable bequest, people with no religious preference at all. Not a shocker. We saw what giving was from those who attended twice a week to those who never attend. It correlates as well with bequest giving. People who seldom attend worship. Those are the two groups that are least likely to have a bequest in their will. That takes me to the end of my presentation. I am so glad because I've been practicing this for a month, and I hope it went well for you. I hope you learned a lot of good stuff here, and I'm sure there's going to be questions, and if you'd like to ask them when Barbara gets back up here, I'm sure we'd be willing to take them. Yes, ma'am.
I compare that to the slide at the bottom of page 2, the numbers aren't the same. And I know that the on page 2, which is that, it's not a pie chart, it's just a chart. Uh-huh. It says 2007. Is that the difference?
Jennifer, you know the answer to that?
Because the religion on page 2 on the bottom
yes.
says 42%, and it says 58% on the pie chart.
Well, on page 2, 42% is all giving. This is just donor households.
Yeah.
There's the difference. One says all sources of contribution. So religion gets 42% of the pie. Okay. And when you look at just households, as you would expect, it's a higher percentage. Okay. Got it?
Well, listen, we need to be mindful of the clock. So, Lori, would you like to come on up and follow my act? I'm sure you'll do well.
Thank you, John. Good morning, everyone. Get to where I need to start. We're going to shift gears just a little bit in the next few slides that you're going to see, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the economic impact of the Kansas City nonprofit community and focus really obviously on the religious-related organizations. The slide that you're seeing right now is a snapshot of what our nonprofit sector looks like. We've got the percent of total organizations in the light blue bar and the percent of revenue of those organizations by sector in the dark blue. We have a very strong nonprofit sector in Kansas City. We've got over 3,200 organizations, and they are generating $10.78 billion to help support the Kansas City economy and help to sustain our quality of life. Now, you'll notice that the healthcare, the public society benefit, and human services really dominate the economy of Kansas City as far as nonprofits go. I've highlighted the religion related down in the green boxes. What we're going to be doing and moving through in these next few slides, it's a different dynamic of what you've just heard from giving in Kansas City. And so it's very, very important to understand how these dynamics are different. Giving in Kansas City looked just at charitable giving, and that's individuals, households, foundations, corporations, and bequests. What we're going to be pulling in when we look at the whole economic impact, we're going to be adding in earned revenue and also government grants, so the picture looks much different. So just keep that in mind as we go through. Regardless of the different dynamics, you're probably going to be hearing some of the same themes that you have heard already this morning, and that is that Kansas City households and individuals, religion-related organizations are very important to them. And so focusing on that individual donor and household donor is very important, even though, and especially because the religious giving in Kansas City is higher than the national average, affirms that. And I also want to encourage you to look at human services sector and the public benefit sector as well, because the work that you do is so related and so important in those same areas of fulfilling basic human needs and emergency assistance. So it's really important to understand those two. If you have not had a chance to go through the Giving in Kansas City report, I would really encourage you to do that. It's got some great information in there. It was a very significant financial investment by several funders here in the community. If you start into it and you get a little confused or don't understand it, you have got lots of backup and support. Please don't hesitate to call any of us, and we can walk you through it. We want you to be able to use this report, take it back to your organization, and figure out ways that you can apply this information. I'm going to take a little bit of a sidestep here because I have a very difficult challenge this morning in dealing with religious organizations, because so much of the work that they do, they are not required to complete IRS 990s, and we can't capture all the hard dollar revenue that these organizations are doing. But as we look around our communities and our neighborhoods, we see the social impact that these organizations make. So I want to talk about two things right here as a side note, having made that caveat, and that is the benefits of having mega churches in our community and also the tie that we see to the work that the United Way does, or the 211 information calls and the increasing needs that we're seeing in our community in this very difficult economic climate. We are struggling pretty severely with unemployment, and we're going to have to deal with that in the oncoming year or two. It's okay, and that was my fault. So anyway, talking about religious organizations, volunteerism is exceptionally strong in religious-related organizations and around churches. And so it's extremely important that we, there are two things that I found that can really help strengthen volunteerism and sustain that, and that is recognizing and affirming your volunteers and training and supporting them in the work that they do. We are dealing with highly increased demands and changing client needs, and making sure that your volunteers feel very confident and competent in the work that they do, and affirming that. Another thing that you've already heard this morning about volunteers is when people are active in an organization or in, are volunteering, they are also more likely to give. Now, not all of your volunteers may be financially capable of giving, but one of the things that I would ask, number one, have you asked them? Do you know, are your volunteers giving? And also think about ways that you can help to visualize if they think, I've only got $5, that's not going to make a change in my community. If you take that $5 and you bundle that together with 9 other volunteers and that's $50, what does that look like in your organization? Does that provide food for a week for a family of 4? Does it give a homeless person a shelter for a month? If you can create some visual things and generate that, so it's very easy to see that that $5 really does make a difference, it can make the difference in keeping that organization going forward. As far as the mega churches, they have really been successful with three strategies that they have used. And so looking at those strategies and seeing if there are any ways that you can adapt these to your organization in various ways is something that I think is important to think about. One of the things the megachurches have done is they have taken a much greater role in community needs and social justice. They are serving people far beyond their congregation doors. The other thing that they're doing is, and this is really an amazing phenomenon, but by creating satellite locations and multiple services, they have built to scale without increasing or building physical capacity. So they are serving more clients at a reduced cost because of it. And the last thing is changing the types and the styles of services. It's extremely important, you've already seen this from John, that when people are attending church or attending organizations, they're there, they have butts in the seats, they give more. So meeting the needs of the clients and making the organization understand what those needs are can really help to increase both the financial side, and, of course, people get more involved, and it helps to sustain the volunteerism as well. So taking those three strategies, are any of these that you can relate to your own organization to make some changes? Programs that are relevant to clients, and are you still serving the clients' needs as they change in this economy? Okay, we are going to go back to looking at the economic impact, and this is a slide that shows us the breakdown of the religious-related sector, again, based on total percent of organizations in the subsectors and total percent of revenue. And you can see here that there are three subsectors that clearly dominate the revenue, and what is significant about this is these 10 sectors are responsible for 94% of the revenue that's generated and about 86% of the number of orgs that are in the religious-related sector. If you look at this slide and just strictly from an economic standpoint, if you see a sector that is generating a significantly more amount of revenue versus the number of organizations that are in the sector, you might come to the conclusion, well, these sectors maybe are operating more efficiently, they're more long-term sustainable. That may be the case, but that may not be the case. And what's important in this to realize is looking at program outcomes. Are the programs that your organization is serving its clients for, are you getting the outcomes that you need to meet the client's needs? So it's not just always, while we have to have a good solid bottom line, it's not always. It doesn't mean that a successful organization is it can fall through if the programs are not meeting the needs of the clients. Yes. Those are based on a national classification that's set by the IRS and another national nonprofit. And so those are classifications that are on the IRS form. If any of you are interested in knowing which organizations fall into these categories, if you can email me or give me your business card at the end of the session, I'll be glad to follow up with you on those. And really that reiterates the importance of looking also beyond just religious-related organizations, but also public society benefit and the human services as to how Kansas Cityans give, because it can be very interrelated. This next slide is looking at the diversity of the annual revenue of religious organizations, and this is a very significant slide. You see we've got broken down categories of ranges of revenue. We've got over 40% of the religious-related organizations that are very small organizations. They're operating with budgets under $99,000 a year. If we bundle a couple more categories, we have over 80% of the organizations operating under $250,000 a year, which is a very big part of the sector. And so what this tells us is these organizations have to be relying on the power of volunteerism in order to maintain and serve the amount of client base that they have. Something I want to mention, we want a lot of this session obviously to be very interactive and dynamic so that you feel like you have moved forward when you leave here. In working with smaller organizations, one thing that I want to mention that I think John mentioned in one of his earlier slides was working with, thinking about the power of collaboration, just casual relationships, coming to the learning circles at the Nonprofit Connect, looking for ways to help keep your organization sustainable in the long run. One of the things that is becoming very popular, and it's been a massive change really over the last 2 years, is how young professionals view the organizations or the for-profits that they go to work for. Social responsibility has really been moved into the area of benefits. Not only do they want health care and retirement plans, but they want to know how these for-profits are contributing back into their community. So within the areas that you serve, are there any even small proprietorships? They don't have to be at a corporate level. Or businesses that your organization can partner with to create employee volunteer programs, team work type things, and then pulling those employees into your organization. We know that as they volunteer, they become more active and they have a greater likelihood of giving to the organization. This is the last slide before we move on to another section. And this is really demonstrating how many organizations, the percent, are operating with revenue greater than expenses. And what we see here is that only 61% of religious-related organizations are being able to at least break even. And so, again, this is a familiar theme. How do we maintain our financial ratios, meaning how do we meet our expenses and continue to serve the increasing demands of our clients? And again, it's about networking, connections. A couple of things that we do know is that if you can find a donor, a business, a funder, a church, it can be any type of thing that will offer a match. It doesn't matter whether it's 10 cents on the dollar, 50 cents on the dollar, or 100%. We know that when people know their dollar is going to be further when they give, they will give. So another idea is to see if you can generate some matching dollars to help continue the long-term sustainability of your organizations. And my last slide here is just really looking at the specific funding sources that help to support religious organizations. There are no surprises here. It is all about charitable giving, individual, and household giving. We've just taken a look at these four primary categories, and what we see in specific funding sources is a predominance of individual donors, trusts, and family foundations. And these trusts and family foundations are driven by individual decisions, which all falls into the realm of charitable giving. We also see some schools and churches supporting this. We also see a very unusual twist in that corporations are not hesitant to get involved with the religious-related organizations in Kansas City also, which is different than the national giving level. So that's another great opportunity, and why I mentioned the possibility of maybe getting employee volunteers within your organization. So that is the end of my presentation, and I'm going to turn it over to Barbara.
Coming on now? Well, Barbara's coming up. I wanted to reflect on that for a minute, because I think Lori said something really, really important, and that is the connection of volunteerism and the corporate side. And I'm going to pick on Dennis a little bit, because as we've worked with City Union Mission, and we found that there were many corporate funders who were willing to engage. Dennis, what do you think? About 80-90% of that came from a volunteer relationship initially. And then as the volunteer relationship grew, they found out they had a heart for the mission. And then it was, what more can we do? Well, we can bring a pallet of donated in-kind goods. We can bring another group down there. So that's really, really an important way to connect.
Okay, thanks. I want to thank the people who completed the survey that was part of the information that we're including in this report. We didn't have a large number of responses, but we gleaned some information that we will continue to use because we feel it's important. And here is just a brief summary of the some of the organizational changes we saw in the survey. One is the real desire not to have to lay off staff, to try and keep staff engaged or, you know, reduce benefits, defer hiring. And I've talked to several people in the religious community, and they really want to keep staff as long as they can. Collaboration is a huge issue. I mean, it keeps coming up in everything I read, and I think I see, like Kate, you're saying yes, you're reading that also. But the more you can collaborate, and I've recently visited with some nonprofits in a community, and they had a band together to share office space. They were in the public and they found that if they did that, they were saving a lot of money. And in fact, they were sharing executive director, each two of them half time. And again, going back to Colorado, if you don't get the idea that I love Colorado, I'm telling you, I love Colorado. So it's, to me, if you didn't believe in a higher being or a God, then get on top of a mountain on a pair of skis. And either out of terror or appreciation of the beauty, you will, or I do. But there, in that valley, there are five churches that share an ecumenical chapel and office space. Think about the cost cutting. The benefit of that is that those religion, those different denominations work together in that community in a way that is so amazing and respectful of one another. The other is make special appeals. Going again back to a church here in this community, you know how we have some great weather, sleet, rain, snow, things like that, and particularly on Sundays. And Clayton, you should know that. And this particular church, it was about $14,000 a Sunday, which was significant in their overall budget, and it happened two Sundays in a row. And I talked to the minister. I said, well, what'd you do? He said, well, I sent a letter immediately. And the interesting thing was I got more money out of the letter than I would a Sunday service. I said, well, what did that tell you? No comment from him. What?
Not to hear the sermon.
Yeah, right. I'll tell him of that. Some other things, obviously, are to reduce material costs, the printing and things like that. We heard about mailing. And then the facilities. One person said that they really looked at how efficient their building was, buildings were, and cut costs there. I want to share with you a few best practices, and then I want to that we have gleaned from what you, information you shared with us in our professional reading and talking with other people, is that you lead and act from your strengths. So what is it that you are really, really good at doing? And I think sometimes we don't take time to do a strategic plan and really get feedback and information at what really are our strengths and where are areas that we either need to improve or we need to drop. I see more heaping more on the plate to do instead of saying, what do we need to quit doing that's not effective? And because we've always done it since 1939 doesn't mean we have to continue. Stay focused on your strategic plan. That will really help you lead from your strength. Remember, some of your donors are experiencing financial challenges right now. And I think the stories you've heard about matching, you know, what $5 would do, matching gifts, things like that, when you really can see that if I gave $5, what a difference that's going to make if 10 of us give $5. And Lori talking about that visual is wonderful. Be transparent. I mean, tell the truth. And preferably non-guilt producing truth, if you can. I've worked with several churches that let the finances get into dire straits, and had they gone to the congregation and said, look, we're having a cash flow challenge. We need help now. It would have saved months of anguish and a longer time to recover. Share the vision with the congregation members and donors. The more you hear about the vision of an organization, the more inspiring it is. I mean, what's an organization besides your own, please, that really inspires you when you hear about what they're doing? Any comments from what gets you excited? I shared with you, you know, what the Salvation Army was doing in one community. Judy. Yeah. Okay. Other organizations that you maybe do volunteer work that really inspire you. Children's Miracle Network, and isn't that in around Labor Day? Okay. Other things. But think about it. You know. Is it because the more inspired you are, the more you generate that enthusiasm about your own organization and about other organizations. I read somewhere along the line, if you tell people, get the vision in front of them every 30 days or so in some way, that they begin to really absorb it more. Analyze your source of income. You know, if you are in an organization that has large number of aging people, what are you doing about that? Because that's going to become more prevalent as these boomers begin to retire and age more. So I think really analyzing where your income's coming from and the age range of the folks is going to be helpful. Realign your budget with your mission and your programs. I'm sure that you've all done that. I probably am speaking to the choir here. Get more involved in your local community. The more you're out there and present, the more, and Tom's shaking his head. I mean, you guys are doing a great job with your with Restart and Habitat. I hear about you all the time, and I appreciate what you're doing in this community. Tell stories of how your organization is helping other people. I called an organization recently, and what I got instead of a push one for this, push two for this, push three for this, I got, hey, I want to tell you about a great thing that happened in our organization today. A young person came up and said, well, then I'm on that phone. I'm waiting to listen to the rest of this story instead of push button, whatever. So thank your donors over and over again. I don't know about you, but when I get a handwritten note, I'm pretty happy about it. I was on a board of an organization for the 15 minutes prior to the board meeting. We sat down and wrote handwritten thank you notes to all the donors. And it was great because, you know, I learned who some of the donors were. If they gave $10, we wrote a handwritten thank you note. If they gave $1,000, and it didn't take that much time. All right, so there. Now you have what I want to share with you. I'll be happy to talk to any of you after this if you want more information. But it's time for you to talk to us. So what insights did you gain? We're going to pass microphones around. And, you know, what are you taking back? Any of these questions you'd like to answer in the next few minutes? So what insights have we gained here? Oh, that's a great one. I love it.
I have a question.
I have an
answer. Maybe. You talked about aging demographics. Uh-huh. And
I sort of resemble that remark.
Well, you know, that's something that that we have highlighted and been concerned about in our church.
Yeah.
And I think, too, about generational giving and traditional donors, whether that be Salvation Army or City Union Missions or other faith-based causes. What are people in the room doing to engage younger generations? Our church has Facebook. I don't know if we're in a blog. I don't know if we're doing it right. What are y'all doing?
There is a organization right here in Kansas City that is underway to monetize the social medium, such as Facebook and Twitter. And right now there is fundraising going on those efforts, but you have to have a cause that the younger generation catches hold of and does get on fire about. And there are thousands of dollars being raised on the social medias. But here in Kansas City, there is an organization that's getting ready to launch it nationwide in monetizing Facebook. And I look at it. I don't even understand it. Don't pretend to. And monetizing it means in a way like Amway, you know, you would invite your friends to go consider something. If they buy it, you get a residual back out of it, as well as organizations selling you stuff on those mediums. Right now, it's just like, what did I have for breakfast? And nobody cares what I had for breakfast. And so that's some of the things we're looking at and exploring. And again, I think I mentioned to you, Jennifer, some of the reports that I'm hearing that just to stay at the standard of living that Americans are living today, there are some news agencies that are reporting it will require 3 to 5 new revenue streams just to continue to stay at the same standard of living that our donors are staying at today. Now, that in of itself, people are going to be looking, how do I do other things to maintain my own standard of living? And that's going to affect all of the funders in this community, because they're going to, so younger generations are going to be looking, how do they stay with their BMWs and their Lexus and get their resort home ready as we still try and perform the tasks that we've been asked to perform.
Anybody else? Jen? Oh, of course, Church of the Resurrection.
We recognize in the mainline church that there is a decline in younger people going into ministry. And so we have a major initiative over the next 10 years to increase dramatically the number of young people that go into the ordained ministry through our denomination and through our local church. So you know, our senior pastor and like myself, recognize that we need young people to attract young people.
Right.
So one of our youngest pastors on staff is actually now starting an online congregation.
Oh, wow.
Through our church, and we started a new worship venue that my son plays in. He's in the band, and so we're doing everything we can to reach young people. It's still very difficult, and marginal success is difficult even to measure that, but we are definitely working in that area.
One of the things that I have noticed is that the younger generation, the younger working professionals, love to network. And so then if you can put together some type of a networking opportunity for them all to get together where you are also presenting your mission or your story, that can be a very, very healthy way to get a large crowd out and possibly to find some individuals who'll be willing to work with you. The other thing that I saw, and I saw this with the Salvation Army here in Kansas City about 2 years ago, they had a young group of professionals put on an event. And it was an event unlike anything else the Army had done, but it brought together a whole new group of individuals who the Army traditionally does not attract. I think Scott would tell you that the demographics of Army donors is aging, very aging. And so these two bright young professionals came to the Army and said, hey, we'd like to do something with you. Would you be willing to allow us to do it our way? Which was very hard for the Army because they're very conservative, very traditional, but they did it. And they had a fabulous event. I believe that was the case. Scott, you were here at that time, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, we're right at 9:30. Okay. Harold?
I won't take a long time, but there was something that was said during this about butts in the seats or something like that. And I pastor an urban core church. And when I thought about that, I said, you know, that's something that kind of confirmed what we have been talking about anyway. But the thing that really struck me was with the mega churches, I think you're talking about the construct where they're changing their worship styles. And there's an increasing Hispanic demographic in our area. And one of the things that I drew from this is that I've got to make that a priority to be able to have a service that ministers to that demographic in our community.
Great insight. I want to thank you on behalf of everybody. I think we have had a great session here this morning. Look forward to seeing some of you at, or all of you at, more faith-based learning circles that the Connect Now provides. If you have any questions of any of us, we'll be around for a short while after this. Feel free to email us. But we want to thank you for your participation, your great questions, and we hope to see you soon.